Welcome to the Engineering Influence Podcast, presented by the American Council of Engineering Companies and sponsored by the ACEC Life Health Trust. Today, we're going to talk about duty to defend. That may seem like a esoteric topic, but it can have a catastrophic impact on a firm if it isn't handled properly. In the simplest of terms, duty to defend is a contractual obligation whereby one party, in this instance, design professionals, agrees to defend another party, generally an owner or developer, against a covered third-party claim, thus incurring attorney's fees and costs. To look into the implications of duty to defend for engineering firms, we're talking with Brett Stewart, who is the risk manager for the design professional unit of AXA XL. Thanks for coming on the program, Brett.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate that.
So in your experience, I mean, you've been in the business about 20 years, I think. How aware are engineers about the peril posed by duty to defend provisions?
You know, it kind of depends on the level of sophistication of the engineer. And I know a lot of times when we talk about sophistication level, we tend to think, oh, you know, larger firms, mid-sized to larger, certainly they're seeing more volume in terms of contracts. But I also work with a lot of engineers, smaller firms, sole practitioners who are very savvy and they understand these issues. But overall, it tends to be something that frustrates a lot of design professionals. When we talk about the duty to defend, it's a complex issue. And design professionals struggle with it. Their clients and their attorneys struggle with it. And I just think one of the reasons for that has to do with this dynamic that is out there where general contractors and contractors, they're willing to sign these provisions and they can do it. And they can do it because they have a different insurance product that covers contractual liability. It also has a much narrower coverage grant than a professional liability policy, but there's these stark differences in insurance products. And it takes a little bit of getting used to that, getting spun up on that to fully understand it. And what I find is a lot of clients particularly don't understand it either. So you've got engineers who are struggling with that and struggling to understand it. And you sort of overlay that on, you know, what is the claims history of that firm? And, you know, I've dealt with a lot of firms who have, you know, thinking back in the days when I handled claims, somebody pick up the phone and they say, you know, this is the first claim I've had in 25 years, right? So when I talk about these duty to defend provisions and these other contract provisions, you can go your whole career signing bad contract provisions and maybe nothing happens. But it's only when it does happen that it can really matter and it can really color how a claim is handled, how it's disposed of, and what the ultimate cost of that claim is. So I think the claims history is a big piece of that. And certainly for firms that, you know, if you have lived through a claim where this is a prominent issue, well, then you're going to have that experience and that's going to mean something to you. When we think about our contracts, they really are the foundation of your risk management. It's the first thing that we look at when a claim comes in. So just understanding how that dynamic can impact you later on in a claim it's a big issue, and not a lot of engineers are dealing with it just because you don't get hammered by these things on a regular basis. They tend to be these sort of high severity losses that are low frequency that can really matter. This is also another reason why education is so, so important, you know, and when we're talking about education, you know, when we survey our firms, everybody says that education and training is absolutely important. But firms struggle with it. And they struggle with it because every time that you are, you know, taking a course, reading something, you're not billing for it, right? And a lot of firms, especially when we think back to, you know, 2018, 2019, when the economy was really hot, that they're struggling in terms of staff training. But there's a lot of resources, right, that we try to steer, you know, our insureds to. They've got brokers. That broker is the first line of defense. These are folks that deal with this type of stuff all the time. Their insurance company, that, you know, you should not hesitate to reach out to your broker and your carrier to provide education services, whether it's webinars, in-firm presentations, whatever it is. But we've also got lawyers, we've got industry organizations like ACEC, and all of these together, you know, you've got this just access to all these educational resources that are either free or very low cost. One of the things that we have is a contract guide with over 133 topics and growing. And one of the chapters on that is indemnities. And it's a it's a pretty detailed chapter, and that'll be available for download on this podcast for anybody who wants to take a look at it. Because I think that's the kind of thing that if you start to read up on these things, you can at least understand sort of where that negotiation begins and ends, right? What, you know, planting a stake out there in the ground and saying, you know, this is what I would prefer to have. And you might not end up with it, but in terms of a starting point, here's how we treat the duty to defend. Let's get rid of it if we can. And if not, what else can we do? So that's kind of sort of it in a nutshell, I think, Jerry.
You use the term hammered. It can be catastrophic, can't it, for an engineering firm if they're required to pay for the defense of an owner or developer in a court case that can go on for months or even years?
Well, you know, and that's one of the things that a lot of firms don't appreciate until you've been through it. So that duty to defend, when we're talking about the duty to defend, it's not covered by your professional liability insurance. It is an uninsured exposure. And it depends on how hard a client or somebody who you are agreeing to indemnify is willing to push on that. So it is possible, and we see it from time to time, where, you know, somebody goes into court and during the pendency of a claim seeking essentially declaratory relief from a judge. Basically, during the claim, you have to pay these legal expenses. And how bad that is going to be is going to depend a lot on the precise wording and language in that indemnity provision, both with respect to the duty to defend, and then everything else you're doing in there, from the folks that you're indemnifying to the types of damages that you're providing indemnity and defense for. So this can be a real pressure point. And I'll tell you, when we are resolving claims, you know, you look at a lot of these different things. It's one thing. It's the duty to defend. It's a prevailing party fee clause. It's an elevated standard of care. So when we step back and we start to look at what else is showing up in this contract, that uninsurable duty to defend could be made a lot worse by a lot of other contract provisions.
So why isn't this just a lawyer-to-lawyer thing? Why isn't it the engineer's lawyer talking to the owner's lawyer and figuring this out?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. And sometimes firms are reaching out to counsel. I would say that, you know, it's some attorneys really struggle with these issues as well, right? So it's a challenge sometimes to find that lawyer out there who understands how these provisions work, both from a drafting standpoint and preferably somebody who's litigated these issues, but also an attorney who is up to speed on the coverage implications. They know how your policy works. And that takes some time and some effort, right? You've got to educate that attorney. There's a lot of different insurance products out there. I think in the professional liability space, there's something like, you know, 65 carriers. And we can draw analogies in terms of the things that are the same, the common thread in a lot of these policies, like the contractual liability exclusion. But when we're drafting contract clauses, you really need to get into your policy and you need to have contractual provisions that track that policy language to the best extent possible. So I think sometimes finding that right attorney can be a challenge. But again, you know, firms have access to their broker, to their insurer. Certainly, we work with a network of attorneys throughout North America who understand these issues. They do this for a living. So finding those folks. But there's also, I think, a lot of times some reluctance on the part of any design firm, because every time you reach out to your attorney, that's going to cost money, right? Your lawyers are billing for it. Now, sometimes they'll provide some free advice or answer a quick question. But when you are reaching out to counsel outside your firm, or maybe looking at bringing on an in-house counsel, bringing on a general counsel, maybe you're looking at a contracts coordinator, a risk manager, these are overhead positions. And I think a lot of firms struggle with this. And it kind of depends on the business model as well, right? In terms of your profitability and the things that might erode that profitability. But it's hard for some firms to get there. They're looking at these salaries and they're thinking, well, this is just overhead. Or they're looking at the hourly burn rate on having an attorney review your contract, draft your contract. I would say that it's absolutely imperative. You know, it's a decision as to who you want to hire inside your firm to navigate these issues and to help you with it. But I am a firm believer that, you know, reaching out to your counsel at least once a year to review your terms and conditions, to update your firm and the folks who have contracting authority on any changes in the law. These are things that are, you know, they're really important to do, and it's worth spending that money. I also think sometimes that, you know, the best folks, if they have the experience and the education, engineers are the best folks to negotiate these contracts. And I can say that sometimes when you start injecting lawyers into the negotiation process, it can kind of polarize things. So we look at a lot of our insureds, and you know, 80% of their business is repeat clientele, and they've got really good relationships over on the client side, or if they're a subconsultant, you know, with the prime. And that's a big piece of risk management right there that we shouldn't discount. And sometimes pulling a lawyer into that can sort of polarize things a little bit. But that doesn't mean that you can't have your lawyer operating in the background, advising you in the background. And every now and then, it makes sense to have two lawyers actually sit down and talk about something. So it's not always a bad thing, but it can cost a little bit of money. But again, you know, I encourage firms not to try to do this on their own, right? You've got your broker is there, your carrier's there. You've got industry groups like ACEC. These are all folks that you can reach out to, network with, and get some answers.
So if you have a negotiation with the contract, and there's a duty to defend in provision in the contract, given what can happen with something like that, is it sort of like a no-go situation that you say, if this duty to defend provision stays in the contract, I'm not interested?
Well, not necessarily, you know. And, you know, I'll tell you this. When I talk to firms, you know, one of the things I say is, if you do everything I tell you, you'll never get sued and you'll never win any work, right? there's this commercial reality to this. And it really depends on the types of projects you're working on and the types of clients that you're working with. Certainly, if you're working on, you know, a lot of public projects, federal projects, there's very little or no room to negotiate some of these things. And there's a lot of work there. And firms can make a very good living and can be very successful in that space. But a couple of things. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't try where possible. I understand that sometimes you respond to an RFP and it says, well, you know, if you take any exceptions to this contract, you know, we're going to take you out of any consideration. But there are a lot of municipal projects, a lot of public works projects where you do have an opportunity to push back and to negotiate these things a little bit. But even if it is, you've got to defend them, right? You've got to defend your client. It's still important for firms to go through that process. Yes, that's a red flag. Yes, that creates an uninsured exposure. And assuming you can't do anything to mitigate that exact term, you can't turn it into a reimbursement, you can't fit it within, for example, our policy has a reimbursement language in the definition of damages that makes it covered. And if you can't do that, you've got this uninsured exposure. But the question then is, what else can I do, right? What else can I do in this indemnity clause? Can I put a negligence trigger onto this, right? I'm going to defend, indemnify, hold harmless the client, you know, to the extent caused by my negligence. That is something that can mitigate the impact of that. Are there any other things that we can do to mitigate that defense obligation? For example, the scope of the indemnities, the people that you're going to indemnify. From time to time, we see contractors show up in that, and that's a huge issue. So when we talk about that duty to defend, it's going to be, who are we defending and against, you know, and as to what, right? What are we saving them from? And then there's also things that firms can do to try to work into their contracts, whether it's a limitation of liability, where you're going to limit your liability, if anything, if not to a certain dollar amount, but to, you know, not to exceed the amount of available insurance proceeds on the policy, something that takes away that uninsured sort of excess liability, something that is open-ended and it's hard to gauge. Some firms are good at working into their contract, maybe a waiver of consequential damages. And that can really matter depending on the type of project that you're working on. You know, when I think about, you know, some of the claims from time to time that I've seen, it's a fast track project, and maybe it is a hospital, you know, or healthcare. So you've got something that has a lot of consequential damages, a lot of economic loss attached to it. I like to use that hospital example. You know, each day that that project is late, each day that hospital is not open, it, they're missing out on diagnostic tests and surgeries and a whole host of things, right? It could be huge dollar items. So there's different things that you can do to mitigate that uninsured duty to defend. And then that's all just part of, you know, where does this fit in your project evaluation, your go, no go, right? We talk about the contract being part of that, but for a lot of firms, if they can't negotiate those terms, what else are they going to do, right? They're going to put their A team on this project. They're going to increase their quality management. It's going to be a second set of checks. They might reach out to their client and say, okay, in that case, we want to have more opportunity to go out to the site and conduct site visits, and we want you to pay for it. So there's different things that you can do to help mitigate that.
Yeah, that, I mean, those sound like very practical steps to take and to make sure that you can do the job. But have you, have you ever had instances where engineers have just walked away because the contract just wasn't to their liking?
Well, absolutely. And typically when that happens, it's a, there's a lot of things going on, and it's, they're putting that into their, they're stepping back, looking at their project evaluation, saying, look, we've got this really difficult contract. It's got the uninsured duty to defend. And maybe there's other things, you know, prevailing party fee clause, which typically always the majority of the time operates against our design professionals. Maybe there's an elevated standard of care. Maybe they don't have ownership of their documents. Maybe there's a slow pay provision in that contract. And it's a difficult client, a low bid contractor that has a history of litigation. Their fee has been whittled way down. All of a sudden you start to look at this and you say, this doesn't make sense for us. And part of that, you know, when we're thinking about these deal breakers, how significant they are to a firm can really depend on a firm's own risk appetite. And what are they willing to do in terms of a business decision? And a lot of that can be driven by the economy. So I think back to the Great Recession in 2009, and firms were coming out of that, and it was just this existential crisis for so many firms. They were struggling to keep the lights on, struggling to keep as many folks employed as possible. A lot of firms didn't make it. A lot of people left the industry, and we're still sort of reeling from that. But that notion that a lot of firms at that point were just signing what was ever in front of them. They knew the risk, they had to do it. So, you know, when we look at what happened last year in 2020, the pandemic, it's not like the Great Recession. Some firms did very well, some firms really struggled. So it kind of remains to be seen the economic factors that can impact that. But I definitely think when we talk about walking from a project, it's the firms who understand at the RFP stage, what am I never going to do, right? And sometimes at that go, no go, they might rank those types of things, but there's certain things that are going to be a real deal breaker for them. And one of the, you know, and I rarely ever tell firms, well, you should never do that, right? But when it comes to, for example, looping in contractors into that list of indemnities, or other consultants hired by the owner, which could be a geotech, somebody you have no control over, and that could be very high risk discipline. Those are the types of things that in my mind are deal breakers. You're typically defending your client, a contractor, maybe a geotech. That is something that can really just torpedo a firm. And that's the kind of thing that you would want to walk from no matter what. But you know, what we're also seeing going on in the industry right now is, and we've been talking about this, the industry's been talking about this for a couple of years, is management transition. You know, as we're seeing folks that are retiring or they're stepping back from their management roles, and you're bringing up a new crop of engineers, mid-level folks, and the challenge there is they don't necessarily have the experience that somebody who is in their 60s who's stepping back from has. They haven't lived through those claims, possibly. Sometimes they do. So it can be a struggle for firms trying to pass down that institutional knowledge to the next level of management. And what we see from time to time is that you've got this sort of up-and-coming crew of engineers. And, you know, they can really be drawn to the financial rewards of some of these larger projects, and they might discount some of these contractual issues. And, you know, the disciplined firms understand the risk going into it. They know what they're going to do. They know what they're not going to do. And this is now, I think now it's more important than ever, because we're also seeing something else going on right now, and that is a huge uptick in claim severity. And some people say, well, yeah, projects are bigger, you know, bigger projects, bigger problems, and that's part of it. But we're also seeing the severity being driven by social inflation, where we talk about the rising cost of claims that is really due to societal views that tend to discount the impact of large numbers, right? We are seeing so many large numbers in our lives these days. I mean, we talk about some of these rescue packages, infrastructure bills, trillions of dollars. It's hard for folks to understand that. This type of thing, this is you're being sensitized to it, and it results in oftentimes higher jury verdicts. There's a whole movement on the plaintiff's bar when it comes to bodily injury, wrongful death cases, to it's called the reptile theory, to really, when it comes to safety and those types of themes that show up in trials, to really capitalize on that. And they're getting massive jury awards with it as well. So you've got high damage cases with maybe spotty or little liability, and our engineers are still getting hit on these things. So there's a lot of different things that are weighing into this. So I think, you know, being disciplined, especially now when it comes to your contract, you know, this is the thing that's gonna color how you, you know, survive a claim, and knowing what you'll do and what you're not gonna do.
So, I mean, if you're an engineering firm facing this situation and you have a contract in front of you with a duty to defend in it, as well as other provisions, in your view or in your experience, what provisions should the engineering firm press for, and which ones do they tend to get to have like this to taken out of the contract?
Well, you know, and again, it depends in large part on the types of projects you're working on. What is the contracting environment in that segment, right? But working with certain clients, working on certain project types. But what I would tell any firm, so I mean, you might look at some firms who have, you know, they work on a variety of project types and they have success in one segment with their contracts and not with another. I think as a starting point, You need to have a set of terms and conditions, maybe and never get it signed, but this is our best foot forward. And this is the thing that we want to train everybody in our firm who has contracting authority. Here's how we want our contract to look like. And then from there, when you go through that negotiation process, you're able to gauge how far am I deviating from this, right? So I think knowing what that starting point looks like, and also trying to start with that option. So for example, we talk about disclaiming the duty to defend. And in certain jurisdictions, you need to expressly disclaim it, not just cross it out, but expressly disclaim it. And what I see happen a lot is, you know, some of our engineering firms, they say, well, I know the client's never going to agree to this, so let me try something else. Let me try, you know, let me water this down a little bit. And you're sort of doing yourself a disservice. You're bidding against yourself. You've already made that first concession. Your client doesn't even know it. And again, this is assuming, I'm looking at these projects where there is an ability to negotiate these terms. But a lot of firms are bidding against themselves at this stage. So for example, you might say, look, we don't want to agree to a duty to defend. It is uninsurable. What we're willing to do, if you have a policy like ours or a few of our competitors that provide that reimbursement in there, right? Or whatever the policy is, right? Try to track that language and you can go to your client and say, look, here's where we can find coverage for this. And they may push back on that. But at the end of the day, you have a better chance of getting that reimbursement. Even if there is nothing in your policy that says it's covered, it's no longer an upfront obligation. It takes a bit of that sting away from it. But if you don't come out from a negotiation standpoint, if you don't come out and say, look, we don't want to do this, we want to disclaim the duty to defend, then I think you've sort of bid against yourself. But that's, you know, it's an interesting thing too, when we talk about some of these tactics that are out there, you know, some of the things that I'm seeing with our firms, and I see this more in the and public space, public works projects, is you've got this notion of a bifurcated indemnity. You've got two indemnity provisions. And sometimes what I see with our insureds is they're working across the table with their counterpart, you know, at a municipality or a city or a county transportation authority. And that individual has a checklist of things that they need, and and that defense obligation is on it. And part of the times where I'm seeing firms successful sometimes saying, look, we'll give you that. We'll give you that, you know, rock solid indemnity obligation for everything other than general liability. And for general liability, we're going to disclaim that duty to defend or make it into a reimbursement obligation. And so you've got two indemnity provisions showing up in that contract, and it is largely perceived as a win-win, right? The vast majority of claims against engineers are gonna hit the professional liability, but for somebody who needs to get these, you know, I'm looking at the client side, they need to get these provisions in their contract, they get something there as well. I'm also seeing, you know, this reimbursement option, and I'm seeing some municipalities, some public agencies, and certainly more private developers, some of the clients in the high tech space, they're understanding how the policy works. They're understanding that they can get insurance dollars by being reimbursed reasonable defense costs caused by the engineer's negligence. So there's a little bit of education that is sort of filtering down, I think, on the owner side as well, where attorneys understand, you know, think about it, if you're an owner attorney, you got an obligation to get the best deal for your client. And just having a hollow promise to pay an open-ended defense obligation doesn't mean as much as having an insurance company stand behind that obligation. So, you know, we're seeing some firms getting some traction there. But I would also say that, you know, I think that there's two different ways this tends to go. For states that have anti-indemnity legislation, they've got some sort of bill that limits or restricts the duty to defend and indemnify. And a lot of times that negotiation falls into that statutory language. And I would just encourage firms to focus on the coverage first, because not all of these anti-indemnity statutes create a covered risk, right? You might still have a duty to defend, but maybe it's limited. We still got to be thinking about the insurance limitations, the contractual liability exclusion. So let's focus on the coverage in our policy. Talk to your broker, talk to your carrier, talk to your lawyer. And then if need be, you can start filtering that, you know, applying the individual state's anti-indemnity statutes.
To circle back on something you said earlier about contract language that requires the engineer to indemnify other contractors, doesn't that seem like it really pushing the envelope there? Doesn't that, it feels almost unfair.
Well, it is pushing the envelope. I don't see it all the time, but it's happening enough. And hopefully, you know, I think a lot of firms are sort of picking up on that. But this kind of goes into this category, if you don't ask, the answer is going to be no. And I've actually seen the opposite of this happen, where our engineers have a really, really good longstanding relationship with a client, with a, maybe it's a water district or a transportation agency, and they are being listed as an indemnity on the contractor's policy. So, you know, I kind of see it work both ways. The difference is, a contractor has insurance to pay for that. A design professional does not. So I definitely, yeah, I think it is unfair. I think that when we look at that list of indemnities, where you have a whole host of individuals or companies or entities that are defined as the client or the owner, you got to spend a lot of time sort of parsing through that. We always tell firms, look, you should indemnify, you know, the folks you contracted with against damages caused by your negligence. That's basically what the common law says. If I make a mistake, I'm going to be responsible for that mistake. But all of a sudden, if we're indemnifying contractors, that can be so open-ended. And And the impact of that is going to be, you know, whether it is a defense obligation or just straight indemnity, that's a huge difference. You know, ideally, if you make a mistake and somebody else suffers damages, then you should have to pay for that mistake. But when we start filtering in these third parties, you have no control over them. And it just depends on the breadth and the depth of that indemnity language and whether or not there's a defense obligation. That can make it a big deal. So I think, you know, when I talk to firms, that is one of the few just absolute deal breakers that I would steer folks away from. You know, do not agree to indemnify a contractor, a consultant that you didn't hire, or anybody else.
And just one other thing, you earlier on, you mentioned the negligence trigger. What is that, and how is that important to engineers?
Well, when we talk about, you know, a negligence trigger, a professional liability policy covers negligence. So from one standpoint, we're trying to fit that indemnity provision into the four corners of that insurance policy. So for example, a lot of indemnity clauses might say that you will indemnify, you know, defend, indemnify, hold harmless the client, whole host of other entities for anything arising out of or pertaining to your work, which arguably means you might make a small mistake that doesn't breach the standard of care. That's not negligent. And all of a sudden this obligation is triggered. So having it tied to your negligence is a better way to pull that into the coverage grant of your policy. What I'm also finding too, though, is, you know, it's a good way when we're talking about negotiation and negotiating these clauses. You know, if you could just redline the whole indemnity clause, and that tends to really polarize the negotiation process. I'm not saying you shouldn't do it. Sometimes we have to do it. But I am seeing engineers, they're successful in getting this thing across the finish line, in part because they have this, they're tying their obligation to negligence, right? So anything, you know, that indemnity provision will sort of end with to the extent caused by the engineer's negligence. That is a much better way to mitigate the, you know, this sort of onerous indemnity provision. And a lot of times you can sort of bring it in. It's a better way to bring it into coverage. It doesn't necessarily mean it will be covered in a claim. But having that negligence trigger, it turns it into a negligence causation. And oftentimes it gives firms a little bit of room to argue in a claim. Look, you're asking for this upfront defense obligation, but, you know, this is not caused by our negligence, and this has not been determined yet. And sometimes that can take, for example, that uninsured duty to defend, and it tacks it on to the end of the claim as a reimbursement obligation. So I definitely think you can use that in a way that you're making very few changes or far fewer changes than redlining the whole provision. And that's an easier way, I think, to get somebody to agree to it.
Well, I think that's a good place to end the conversation. It covered a lot of issues. I really appreciate you coming on the program.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate you having me. And you know, I just wish everybody success as you're going through this. I don't know what this next year is going to hold, but we might find that there's a lot more work out there. So we just want to make sure we're being diligent on our contracts and understanding that risk before we take it on.
And thanks very much. As you mentioned, we'll have a link to the download of the AXA-XL's chapter on indemnity in the podcast description.
Absolutely. Certainly.
So this is the Engineering Influence Podcast, presented by the American Council of Engineering Companies and sponsored by the ACC Life Health Trust. Thanks for listening.